Today's episode of Gluck Radio is proudly brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks, offering titles in every genre. Now, I want you to go and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/gluckradio. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. If you're a fan of this show, you might like to download American Savage by my fellow podcaster and sex advice columnist, Dan Savage. Or how about Crush It? Why now is the time to cash in on your passion by Gary Vaynerchuk. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Now more than ever, Americans face regular emotional assaults stemming from work, relationships, as well as home. These injuries can interfere with our minds and hearts in ways that at first seem harmless enough, but can linger until they become severe problems, both psychologically and emotionally. Joining us in the studio is psychologist Guy Winch, author of the book Emotional First Aid, to give us tips for all problems, large and small, relating to rejection, guilt, failure, low self-esteem. Just like any scrape can be infected, little bouts of rejection or guilt can turn into real problems down the road. All of Winch's tips are user-friendly and based on recent scientific studies and compelling case studies from his private practice. Between Winch and myself, the doctors are in. It's time to get fixed. Guy, welcome.
It is an absolute pleasure. I enjoyed your book very much, and the topics are so relevant because almost every single one of the topics, the truth is, this is why people walk into my office every day. And it is, you pick topics that almost everyone can identify with, you know, completely. So, emotional first aid. What does first aid mean? You know, is it before you send them to the ambulance or what?
It actually means the same thing as it would mean when you thought about physical first aid. We all have a first aid or medicine kit at right. home, and it has our Band-Aids and our antibacterial ointments and our ice packs and our pain relievers. And we use those for common physical injuries like cuts and scrapes and colds and those kinds of things. And when we get those kinds of injuries, we know how to assess them. We know that the cut needs the ointment and the Band-Aid. And so I wrote this book because my feeling was that we get emotional injuries, psychological injuries, that are mild in that same way, but we get them even more frequently than we do cuts and scrapes and colds. And yet we don't have that kind of medicine cabinet. We don't have a series of treatments we could apply that we don't need to rush to the doctor for, that we could apply at home, that we could prevent a quote-unquote psychological cut from becoming infected. And there was a lot of research to indicate that we do have the ability to take those kinds of steps. So I called it emotional first aid because I think the book should be used in that same way. When you experience something that's painful emotionally or psychologically, there are things you can do.
I'm actually fascinated by that, and I'm going to ask you some specific questions. One of the things that I guess I want to start off by saying is that there are people who are more prone to getting cut and bruised, depending upon how they were raised, and that when we start with someone, something like, let's talk about rejection, my famous quote that all rejection is self-rejection. You're looking at me, I'm bald, I'm about 15 pounds overweight. If you told me I'm bald and fat, well, you're right. It doesn't bother me because it's just a fact, and it doesn't take away from my identity. Does the book address simply how to keep it from actually getting affected? But does it also address the need for a person who keeps on getting cuts and bruised to take a look at what is it that they need to fix within themselves so they're not so prone to always need that first aid kit?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the way I divided the book is that each topic has a chapter. So, for example, in the rejection chapter, I start by explaining universally what happens to us emotionally, psychologically, behaviorally when we get rejected, because the basic response is the same. Now, the severity of that response, the frequency of that response, that will probably vary based on the people. But right now, our general approach to these kinds of minor emotional injuries is neglect them, because we don't pay attention to them. We don't take any kind of action necessarily. We feel rejected. I say to people, what's your first thing you do when you get rejected? And the responses I get most is tequila, sometimes ice cream. Right. But that's the best. That's our arsenal.
So they don't really ignore them. What they do is they act out. So let's discuss the physiology of rejection. What happens when a person feels rejected, and why do they feel rejected?
So when a person feels rejected, and it could be as mild these days as you posted your vacation pictures on Facebook and the friends that you liked their vacation pictures didn't like yours, and you feel bad by that. That can be a mild rejection. Or you went on a blind date and the person wasn't interested in a second one, or you get dumped after seeing somebody for a couple of weeks, etc. There are many of those kinds. You didn't get invited to the neighborhood barbecue, whatever that formulation is. And what was interesting about it is when researchers look at what happens to us when we get rejected, they actually looked at what happens in our brain. They did functional MRI scans, in which those are the kind of scans where you actually have somebody lie on an MRI machine and have them think or do something. And then you can see what areas of the brain get activated in that context. So they did functional MRI scans, and they asked volunteers, they did get paid, but they asked the participants to come in if they've experienced a recent heartbreak and to bring a picture of the person who broke their heart. And they had them lie in the functional MRI machines looking at the picture while reliving the breakup. So that activated the rejection pathways in their brain. And the researchers were really surprised, because what they found was exactly the same pathways get activated in our brain when we experience rejection as get activated when we experience physical pain. It's literally the rejection pathways piggyback on the physical pain pathways. And so that's why even small rejections can really sting, because we are literally wired to respond in a strong way to any kind of rejection.
I mean, I agree. I mean, my practice is based around neuroplasticity, medical hypnosis, which actually means that the neurological and the response actually becomes the physical response. So not only does the study make so much sense, but there's a lot of science behind it. At what point do you size up a person and give them comfort rather than say, man up or woman up and listen, part of life, if you're going to go on dates, someone is not going to like you. Like, when do you not put a Band-Aid and just say, grow a set of balls?
So to me, first of all, it's actually important that people know, because part of what happens is you went on a date with somebody that you didn't even like that much, but the fact that they didn't want to go on a second date with you somehow really stings. And then the other part comes in which you start thinking, well, what's wrong with me? That my feelings are hurt. I must be such a loser. I didn't even like that person that much. So it's important for people to know that it stings for really neurological, as you say, reasons, for this is how our brain is wired. But there are also steps people can take to alleviate that sting. And to answer your previous question, the more you treat yourself with these kinds of techniques, the more emotional resilience you build. And it's about building emotional resilience, because if you're dating, you're going to get rejected a lot. But if you actually take certain steps when it stings more than in other situations, you'll find that it tends to sting a little bit less as you go on, because you can build emotional resilience by doing these things and therefore be a little bit more, protected from these events of daily life.
Guy, talk to me about these things. Talk to me about the actual Band-Aids. What do they look like? What do they sound like? What type of ointment are you putting on, let's say, rejection?
Okay, so in rejection, there are a few different things. Like in that chapter, I try and specify what the emotional wounds are that we sustain, and then I give treatments to address each of those wounds. And so you kind of have to see how you're being affected and then choose the treatments. But just as one example, one of the things that gets really hurt when we get rejected is our self-esteem. And in, let's say we got rejected in a dating scenario, we're going to, you know, go home and feel like, oh, I wish I were taller or blonder or more successful or this or that, and that's a natural way to think. And so then the next time we go on a date, we're going to feel a little bit more insecure and a little bit, you know, more trepidatious because of what happened. So one of the band-aids I suggest for that, and all these band-aids, by the way, are ones that were really demonstrated in scientific studies, in more than one scientific study, in peer-reviewed journals, in good journals, to show that this kind of thing helps. So one of the things we need to do is to, rather than actually self-bash ourselves, do negative self-talk and, you know, become very self-critical after a rejection in a romantic scenario, we need to boost our self-esteem. And one of the most effective ways to do that is, for example, to make a list of all the qualities you have that make you a good relationship prospect, a good dating partner. And you list all those things. There should be at least 10, 15 on them. You give great back rubs, you're a very good socializer, supportive, loyal, emotionally available, whatever that list would be. Then choose one item from that list and write a 2-paragraph essay about why that's actually important, how you've expressed it in the past or how you might in the future, and how why the other person would find that valuable. And that little writing exercise, a 5-minute writing exercise, will actually remind you, okay, this is what I have to bring to the table. So instead of focusing on all the things you're not and wish you were, you're actually focusing and reminding yourself of all the things you do have to offer. And that will make you feel better in terms of your self-esteem in the moment. It'll really soothe in the moment. It'll reduce the emotional pain. It'll also reduce your levels of anger and frustration. And if you do that a lot, then you really do start to build emotional resilience, because you take these things a little less heavily when you've done that kind of exercise repeatedly.
And I like what you're saying, but I probably would say what we're looking for is the person having a sense of true identity. This is who I am. This is what I bring to the table. And, you know, part of that is the elimination of the rumination, the going over and over and over of why did she reject me? Well, you have keys on you, I'm sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if I asked you to open up the locked front door, could you do it?
Right, that's not
you
the right key.
You couldn't, because it's not the right key. Sometimes rejection is simply about not the right key, because there are lots of women and men who choose people who don't have a whole lot of traits. There's just something, there's the chemical dynamic of those little pherones under the tongue. And very often we choose not logically but just emotionally. But what I do very much appreciate is the advice that you don't go over and over and over and make it about I am not lovable. Okay. And you do have a good sense of self, and what it sounds like part of your first aid is helping a person find their true identity and look at the things they should value and maybe change the things that they should change.
Look, first of all, I completely agree with you that it's about the lock and the key, and I think that's the vast majority of the situations. In other words, if you might think that your lock fitted their key and vice versa, but one of you did not fit the other. And so rejections are usually about that. It's not the right chemistry. It's not the right match. It's not the right time. In that sense, they're not personal. And I completely agree with you. And we should be able to take them as this didn't fit for the other person. And usually what that means is you might have still thought, oh, they were attractive, I'd like to get to know them more. But probably in time, the fit wouldn't have worked for you either, because it does have to mesh together. So I completely agree that's the majority of the situations, that we have to understand that that's where it comes from. And I also agree that we need to have a more solid sense of who we are and be aware of our strengths and be aware of our weaknesses. But our default mechanism is to ruminate about our weaknesses much more than about our strength, when, you know, we don't lie awake at night thinking about, oh, God, you know, that was such a great moment 12 months ago when somebody said something nice to me. We don't. We lie awake at night thinking about 12 months ago when somebody said something nasty to me. And so but you're right. And that really then tilts our own self-perceptions, all of them, in terms of the negative rather than the positive or even the neutral. And we have to compensate for that in some way.
I normally tell people not to look back, always to look forward, and then to look at the methodology of how they're trying to go forward. And And that's why we use the neuroplasticity to kind of rewire the brain. Because what you said before, many people don't understand. Emotional pain is physical pain and vice versa. But having said that, what's the difference between people who were brought up in a very loving environment versus brought up in a very rejective environment? Are the rules the same?
Look, I mean, we know it's really a combination of environment and, you know, genetic predispositions. And so I wouldn't even divide it by loving versus rejecting environment, because you can have somebody grow up in a loving environment but be very rejection sensitive and vice versa.
Correct.
But let's say people who do tend to be more predisposed to being sensitive to rejection, and people who are less so. And so, you know, the people, to me, it's like you said, if you're the one that gets the cold when it goes around the office each time, you need to find ways to boost your immune system. You need to find ways to be healthier because you're more prone. And it's the same thing with these kinds of psychological, emotional conditions. If you're more prone, if your feelings tend to get hurt more quickly, if you get triggered more easily, then you need to do some work. Again, the neuroplasticity, you need to do some work to, you know, reshape some of those networks in your brain so that you can develop more emotional resilience. And you can boost your emotional immune system as much as you can your regular immune system, but you have to work on yourself with that goal in mind.
I completely agree with you. The one thing that you should never do is look to blame, because blaming other people doesn't really help you, and it's not work. It wasn't that it was his fault, it was her fault. It's taking a look at what you need to change so that you like yourself better. And the truth of the matter is that men and women, particularly women, are attracted by a tremendous amount of confidence. For the most part, confidence is the number one thing that women put down when we talk about attraction. We have a power couple service called Platinum Poix. And when we I usually do the forensic profiling. I always do the forensic profiling for it. And when we take a person in, you know, we're really looking at their sense of self-confidence and how realistic it is and how much that they've actually achieved because they ignored pain. Is there a particular route that a person could do to build up their self-confidence?
Yes. I mean, I think that's about really, in a way, building up your self-esteem. And in a similar sense, you want to build it up so it's kind of, self-esteem is like the Goldilocks range. You want it to be, you know, right there in the middle. Too little is not so good. Too much is not so good either, for other reasons. Same with confidence. You know, you want it to be solid and justifiable as opposed to exaggerated and unjustifiable, because then it tends to be a little bit brittle as well. Somebody can come across as solid, but, you know, they respond very strongly.
Now, why is too much self-esteem good? Are you
not good. Yeah, I'm saying.
Why? Tell me why.
Because with the minute you start going into the narcissist range.
But see, self-esteem is not narcissism. Narcissism, I would say, is more a product of low self-esteem.
Well, but the way it comes, unfortunately, the way we measure self-esteem is self-report questionnaires. And so narcissists score very highly because they're, you know, you're self-reporting. We don't have a fMRI scan that measures self-esteem. If we did, that would be really interesting, because that would really change how we think about self-esteem. But
I have to show you my scan.
Okay, well, I would love to see it. But, you know, so when you are a little too full of yourself, when you're a little bit too confident, and it's not tied to your actual achievements, to your actual abilities.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Then it gets a little bit iffy. And
correct.
So people, when they hear that, they say, oh, I need to, like, really act confident. But you have to kind of act within your station, as it were. You know, it has to match the reality.
No, I completely agree. And that's why I say it's really about low self-esteem. Narcissists, and you're right, there's no measure. Someone who continually exaggerates what they do is not exaggerating it because it's out of their identity. It's exaggerating it because they want other people to think it's out of their identity.
Right. In other words, they're compensating.
Right. They're definitely compensating. Which of the areas that you studied did you find the most interesting, and why?
What I found most interesting actually was loneliness.
Hmm.
Because I You know, I mean, I didn't know much more than, you know, most therapists. You know, I knew it clinically. I wasn't that familiar with the research. And the research was kind of alarming, really. Chronic loneliness, I mean, loneliness in general, the first thing it does when you start to feel lonely is it suppresses your immune system functioning. And it does it immediately. Immediately, it suppresses your immune system functioning. Loneliness is similar to being under psychological attack all the time. You are in constant stress. Your body feels like it's in constant stress. And it affects us physically and emotionally, but physically to such a severe degree that scientists have concluded that the risk to your long-term health of chronic loneliness is similar to the risk of cigarette smoking. It literally cuts years of your life expectancy. Now, we don't think of it that way. You know, cigarette packs come with warnings on them. It's, oh, very dangerous. This can kill you. Everyone's aware, well, it can kill me. No one's aware that loneliness can kill them. And no one goes around when they have a lonely friend or they're feeling lonely themselves or a lonely parent thinking, oh, this is something that actually something needs to happen here. We can't just let this go. And so our whole concept of loneliness and what it is, and there are many other aspects that I found that, you know, like it's contagious, we found in social networks. I mean, there's just so many fascinating things about loneliness, and all of them are slightly alarming.
I would say that loneliness is probably more dangerous than your health than cigarettes, because very often if you're having a cigarette in a social setting and you're getting a lot of positive feedback, that the mind is clearly more powerful than the body. And when you're an incredibly happy person, I don't smoke, and I think that smoking absolutely is linked to cancer, so I want to put that out there. Having said that, I think loneliness is linked to every neurotic disease under the sun, both physically and emotionally. But I find that there's two kinds of loneliness. There's cosmic loneliness, which is something that you feel even though you're surrounded by people who care about you. You can't connect. And then I find there's isolation loneliness, where you're simply alone. People, you know, there have been so many reports of how people react in solitary confinement, and that even a short period of time could damage them for years. And yet the loneliness of being with someone in a marriage, friendship, and constantly feeling lonely even more so when they're around is something that people need to realize, that loneliness is not about being alone. It's about being disconnected.
That's absolutely true. And it's actually defined that way. Loneliness is defined as either a social, as you said, the isolation, or an emotional, subjective feeling of disconnection. You can be married. You can have kids in the home. You can seemingly be surrounded by friends and associates and yet feel extraordinarily disconnected from all of them. And I'll give you an example of a case of a class of people who are usually surrounded by people and feel completely lonely.
Comedians.
No. Well, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I used to do stand-up comedy, but
That's actually true, by the way.
Well, I used to do stand-up, and so I'm trying
did
to think
really?
Of, I did, and so I'm trying to think of the people I know, and that's true sometimes. But actually, I was thinking of veterans, returning veterans with PTSD.
Yes.
Because their experience is, I'm here, I'm home with my wife, my family, whatever, I'm back at work, and no one really gets who I am now, what I've been through. No one other than other vets can really get it and can get the flashbacks and what they're going through. And so it really fosters this real sense of isolation, even though, you know, in objectively, they're really surrounded by people. So that's the class. About comedians, I have to say, of which I know many, I would say that's true of some. And I would, maybe not others, but I'm certainly, you know, saying that there are a lot of emotional issues behind people's impulse to become comedians.
So how about yourself? Have you ever felt lonely? Or do you feel lonely?
Actually,
I don't see a ring. You married?
I am not married. I am I gave a recent TEDx talk in Sweden. And in part of it, I spoke about my experience of loneliness. And I spoke about it from the point of view of what happens to our perceptions when we become lonely. And what the research shows and what actually happens is that when you're feeling lonely, whether you recognize you are or not, you start to judge the people around you, your actual friends, your actual family members, you judge them as caring less than they actually do. You judge the relationships as less valuable and less meaningful than they actually are. You actually push people away unconsciously, but you push people away because you are so risk averse to any kind of rejection or any kind of further wound that you just don't take chances. You know, these are the people who won't go to the party because I won't know anyone, even though they don't, you know, that would be a great opportunity. Or they'll go and, you know, they'll park themselves by the hummus and the vegetable dip with a scowl and wonder why no one's approaching them all night when they're putting out such a negative vibe and think, oh, you see, I'm undesirable. But no, that was you creating that. And so I spoke about my own experience when I first came to New York, to America.
Are you from Sweden?
No.
What country?
I am actually from Israel.
From Israel?
I'm from Israel. And I came to get my PhD, and I have an identical twin brother, and we were apart for the first time in our lives. And it was at a time before the internet. You know, international phone calls were really expensive. So we could only afford to speak for 5 minutes a week. And when our birthday came around, we thought we'll splurge. And I waited all day. I paced around my room all day waiting for him to call, and he didn't. And the next morning, I woke up just devastated and realized in my pacing, I had kicked the phone off the hook. And the minute I put it back, the phone rang, and he was livid because it was obviously his birthday as well. And when I said, well, I was just waiting for you to call, he said, why didn't you just call me? You know, I mean, it was my birthday too. We're twins. Why? And I didn't, because I had convinced myself that my brother, who I'm closest with from anyone in the world, I mean, we're just extraordinarily close and always have been, I convinced myself that he didn't care as much because we had been apart now for a bunch of months, so it wasn't that important to him, which is completely untrue. But that was my perception when I was feeling, and that's when I realized I'm feeling lonely because that is distorted, although I was convinced of it.
I think that is an excellent example, and I would say this, that all very strong emotions, fear, anxiety, sadness, loneliness, shyness, distort reality. You know, that your emotional brain and your rational brain do not see things the same way.
Look, that's completely true. And in several chapters in the book, I talk about how, like, for example, in the chapter about failure, I talk about how failing literally distorts your perceptions. Your perceptions about the task that you failed at, your perceptions about your own abilities. There's a distortion, and we need to know when things typically get distorted. We can't always know, but we need to know that in loneliness we're going to have a distorted view of our relationships and our friends. We need to know that when we fail, we're going to have a distorted view of our abilities and the goals that we set for ourselves, because we need to compensate for that distortion and be aware that part of what we're feeling is that distortion and we shouldn't heed it. But we tend to think that our emotions and our feelings and our thoughts are, you know, are really, our minds are like really loyal friends that steer us in the right directions. They often don't, and we need to know when they won't.
The fact that loneliness is something that we talk into ourselves, and in fact, sometimes it's something that cannot be explained. Identical twins are so genetically tied that the loneliness is understandable because it's like being separated from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suggest about the man and the woman who thinks they're not good enough and they feel lonely? What's the Band-Aid that you would use for that?
Well, the first thing they have to understand is that when you're feeling lonely, I mean, that example I gave about what happened at my, you know, on my birthday many years ago, when you're feeling lonely, you have to correct for the assumption that people aren't interested. You know, and because what happens is that a lonely person will, you know, when I say you need to reach out to people, I don't have people to reach out to. And I'm like, well, you have an email contact list. You're on Facebook. All those people are potential people. I'm not saying they're all your best friend, but you need to, you know, have more people in your life. So reach out to them. But how they tend to do that then is to call someone or email and say, you know, you haven't called me in 2 months. And, well, that's not very appetizing. It's not very inviting. And it's also incorrect because they didn't call the other person for 2 months either.
Right.
So you need to, you know, I always coach them on how make it inviting. Call and say, oh, I haven't seen you. Let's have coffee. Let's get together. And schedule things so that, you know, reconnect with people. Because I say you might not be aware, but you've been giving people the signal you're unavailable, you're not interested in certain ways. So reach out, correct that, be pleasant to be around. You know, you start, you know, I call it relationship muscles. Start using those social skills, those social muscles, or those dating muscles. Because what happens, for example, when somebody's, you know, gets divorced and they start dating again, they go on a couple of dates and it goes really badly. Now they When you have the flu and you haven't used your legs for a week and you get up and you're wobbly, you know, oh, my legs are weak because of the flu. But when you go on your first date after a divorce, you don't say, my skills are rusty because I haven't dated in 30 years. You say, what's wrong with me? So be aware that you need to work on your skill set when you're lonely. Social skills, empathy, relational skills. And it'll take you some time to, you know, to oil those up and to make them work more fluidly. So be forgiving, but keep working on them. See it like physical rehab, where you actually, it's a little painful, but you have to do it because the muscles will get stronger as you do.
But what I particularly like about what you said is take a damn action, meaning you're not going to get better by doing nothing and ruminating. In fact, you're going to get worse. And there is no pro-action that you could take that is not going to make things going better. And sometimes you have to challenge your original assumption. Edison said, I know 1,001 ways not to make a light bulb.
Exactly.
Okay. So from my perspective, what I tell my clients is there's no such thing as failure. There's only a learning experience. Meaning all you could do is learn about this works and this doesn't work. That's not called failing. It's called learning.
And here's why I agree with you, because typically we tend to make only 3 or 4 mistakes, but we repeat them in endless varieties. We have our regular blind spots. You know, in other words, you'll see this, people with time management issues have time management issues. Now you thought, well, if you've been labeled as having a time management issue, why don't you correct it? Well, there are blind spots there that make it difficult for them to correct. But failure is your roadmap to where your blind spots are.
Correct.
Each of them will tell you where you can find a pattern that you can change and then wipe out a whole class of mistakes, not just the one or the future one, but a whole class of them. So I completely agree. Failure is your roadmap to success. And without failure, you won't be able to get there. So treat it in that way. It's information.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons, by the way, that people make the same mistakes, it's like taking a nail and scratching it in the table back and forth and back and forth. And you literally become wired that way. You create your own neurology. You know, again, one of the reasons for neuroplasticity is to create a new neural network whereby you're going to take a new action, because it is very difficult for a person. And we see people who in their 50s and their 60s and they have achieved a great deal of success, and yet they're always 10 minutes late, you know, because they've never actually rewired their brain to realize that this is a function of disrespect. This is a function, you know, of a behavior that leads to other people thinking, you know, that they're just not important. And it goes on and on and on. I'm fascinated by the number you gave that people have three primarily problems. I would probably say 3,000 primarily problems. Why three?
I said 3 or 4, but because we typically make the same mistakes over and over again, and the mistake is it's a class of mistake, it's a genre of mistake. You know, in other words, our mistake is we're not sufficiently proactive. Now that can manifest in 1,000 ways,
right?
But not being proactive is a really fundamental error, right? Not respecting the other person's opinion of you. To me, that would encompass also being disrespectful to their time and thinking it doesn't piss them off when you're late, goes in that category. But not being aware how you're coming off to other people is a whole class of error that leads to all kinds of failures and mistakes. And so when you think about it, there's only a few kind of big ones that people tend to have, and then from there come all the others. And if you can identify the big one and correct it, in other words, what I would identify in the lateness is not that you're being disrespectful to other people, I would broaden it to you're not taking other people's perception of you into consideration enough. And that includes being disrespectful of their time and how they respond to it.
One of the things that I like most about the book is you making it very clear that if you don't put a Band-Aid and you don't treat a simple wound, it will fester, it will grow, it could grow into paranoia, it could grow into borderline personality, and not to take anything that lightly when you're reacting poorly emotionally. Because people do so much for their physical health, and they'll spend so much, but they won't do the same thing for their mental and emotional health. And that's one of the things that I really appreciated you pointed out.
Well, I don't say in the book, I'm not disputing, I don't say in the book that these things will lead to personality disorders. I just say these things will lead to all kinds of psychological, you know, issues and mental health issues of a different variety. I'm not drawing the line directly from one to the other.
Okay, so I am.
That's why I want to clarify you are. But the other thing is, I want to say that what I say sometimes is that we spend more time a day taking care of our teeth by brushing and flossing and all of that than we actually do our minds. And there's something really absurd to me about that. And I'm not against teeth. Mm-hmm. But I am for, you know, we spend all this time on our health, even on our teeth, and yet nothing, there is nothing in our daily routines, other than people who do mindfulness meditation or something. But there's really nothing that we do, all of us, to, you know, emotional hygiene, to really make sure that our emotions are healthy. And we should.
And I completely agree, and I'm going to take that one step further and say, to do something about asking the question, listen, we all have our own fingerprints, tongue print, voice print. We are unique. What is our unique identity? Because so many people suffer from what's called, I call TID, temporary identity disorder. They move out of their comfort zone and all of a sudden they can't function. Now, I know you're Israeli, but you have a British accent.
My accent's very confusing.
It's very, yeah, it really is. I was going to, so it is confusing. Is there a Brit somewhere in there?
I spent a few years in England as a kid. I was actually born there, spent a few years there, but the accent remained.
It sounds really good. I like your accent.
I always said to people, you know, when you have a quasi-European accent, you kind of have to become a psychologist in life because that's the expectation.
It goes good, goes well. Okay. What other common scrapes do you find that are pandemic that everyone experiences?
Okay, so you mentioned one several times. I want to actually talk about it just a little bit separately, and that's ruminating.
Okay.
You know, ruminating, when you're kind of going over the same things in your mind, the same scene, the same breakup scene, the same moment your boss yelled at you in the office, and you just keep going over and over it. We tend to think of that as an innocent, you know, activity, as, oh, I'm just kind of processing it, and or I'm thinking through my feelings. But you're thinking through your feelings or processing it the first time you do it. If you're doing it in a problem-solving way, what went wrong there? What can I learn from it? What must I do differently? What did it really mean? If you're really trying to figure something out, all that is well and good. But rumination, by definition, is when you're just chewing over and over again the same scene, the same stuff. You're not trying to figure it out. You're just replaying it, sometimes weeks and months after the event. You know, I write in the book about someone who 3 months after a breakup, all he could talk about with his friends was the breakup, and they just couldn't take it anymore.
Sure,
because it was driving them crazy.
They're digging a bigger and bigger ditch and a bigger and bigger groove, and that's all they can think about.
Right. Now, the ditch and the groove we're digging is bigger for ourselves, because what we do when rumination becomes habitual is it focuses us so much on the stewing instead of the doing, that we literally start to become more passive. Our problem-solving skills take a dip. Our ability to act when we need to declines. There's one study that showed that women who have a habit of rumination and who discovered a lump in their breast waited on average 2 months longer to make an appointment with their doctor than women who discovered a lump who did not have the habit of rumination. Because again, it wasn't 2 months in which they weren't thinking about it. I'm assuming it was 2 months in which they were actually worrying about it and stewing about it, just not taking action.
I like that. You should quote that phrase, stewing and not doing. I like that. We're going to just write that down and quote it, and I'll steal it from you one day.
I think it's ready in the book, so I'm not sure you can.
The one thing, we don't have a whole lot of time, but you're just such a wonderful guest, that I want to underline is that, you know, I always, when I see a police officer or a state trooper, or I see, you know, I always thank them for their service. Mm. But I am more grateful for those who are on the front lines who actually protect this country, you know, and Israel as well, because I'm Jewish and my father was born in Israel, so there's a connection there. You know, the fact that they have post-traumatic stress disorder, I feel, is not as much as what they experienced. and as much as what they experience when they come home. World War II vets did not have the amount of post-traumatic stress disorder in percentage-wise as the vets who come home now, because everyone welcomed them. They were the heroes of the world, and they wore it with pride. And I don't think we do a fraction of what we need to do to make sure that they, you know, we're not just screaming and clapping, you know, when they leave, but we're making sure that we are continually acknowledging that which they gave, you know, for the country and our freedoms that we enjoy. So
I'm going to say I completely agree with that. To me, the fact that we lose more vets to suicide than we do to war is horrific, and that is because we do not do a good job of taking care of them sufficiently when they get home, of taking care of their mental health before they go, because you should be building resilience. And I know there's some programs. Martin Seligman was working on a program to build emotional resilience for vets before they go, but we need to do much, much more. And as a society, we need to be much, much more aware of our emotional state and what we need to do to improve it and to become more resilient in general.
Well, Guy, we could go on for a long time. You were a fabulous guest. You wrote a fabulous book, and I'm going to tell everyone to read it.
Thank you very much for having me.
You were a pleasure. I once again truly want to thank Guy Winch for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of his amazing book, Emotional First Aid, on Amazon.com. And also, check out his website, guywinch.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Check out other episodes at gluckradio.com. And check out, while you're there, glucksolutions.com. Why waste a moment of your life when almost every problem could be fixed in hours and not years? We combine rational cognitive coaching with neuroplasticity, which basically changes the way your brain functions. To every problem, there is a solution. For next time.